One of the things that I'd mentioned when talking about the significance of what's happening in El Salvador with the refugees is something of our history of immigration and our relationships with Latin America. And I had asked last week, and it's always interesting for me to ask people too, but how many people in this group were born outside this country? We're getting to Scandinavia. You have to go back a couple of generations.
Norway and Denmark.
Okay. How about great-grandparents?
My great-grandmother came from Canada.
That's outside the country.
Just across the line.
As any Canadian will tell you. Okay. Do we miss anybody yet? Is there somebody who...
I have a great-grandparent from England.
From England. Okay. And we have somebody new in the group. We're checking out our immigration history.
How far back do you want to go?
Your great-grandmother.
Well, as little as possible, but how far do you have back do you have to go to find out somebody who immigrated to this country?
Four.
No, three.
Three?
Your great-grandmother.
My
great-grandmother.
Okay. From Sweden? Okay. This is really diverse from different places. Just about everybody in this country, I've asked this in congregations, and it's interesting because eventually you go back enough generations and nobody was from here. Everybody came from someplace else. And that is one of the real characteristics of our country, is that everybody comes from somewhere except the Native. I had one Native American family in my congregation in L.A. and they were never, you could never go far enough back. But it's an important thing for us to realize. So we think of ourselves, I think, also as a country of immigrants, and we say, well, that's one of our strengths, and we built this country up on the basis of the strengths of different groups. However, there are a lot of different reasons why people have come to this country, and you can probably name some of them, for example.
Shortage of food.
Okay, yeah. Famine, right.
Political depression.
Political unrest. Yeah, these are the same reasons as last time. Same countries, yes.
My grandpa.
Yeah, they came for husbands.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So there are a number of reasons: economic reasons, political reasons, social reasons. And there's no reason. One reason that's not mentioned here, though, are people who came against their will. Apparently everybody we talked about here were people who chose to come here at some point, whatever reasons were pushing them perhaps to come here. Our recent, and that wasn't the character of U.S. immigration until about the 19th century. And we see that the economic reasons sort of developed a whole new set of immigration peoples. And after the European immigrants had come, and that continued into this 20th century, but in the last century we find immigrating for cheap labor, we found Africa.
Yes, some Europeans were sent to Georgia as prisoners.
Right, that's another part of our history, that they were not, I can't remember if they chose that over against being in prison or whatever. In any case, it was a choice within a non-choice. But yeah, that was part of it too. And then slaves from Africa were brought here unwillingly. And that was a very definite, had probably the greatest impact in terms of immigration of anything else since the European immigration. And then in this century too, learning my history in just the last few years, discovered that Asian immigration happened in this century and kind of in waves. And that was also a type of economic thing, trying to import Chinese immigrants to work on the railroad. I grew up in California, and a lot of Chinese immigrants were brought over to work there, but they weren't allowed to bring women. And so they were hoping they could just use them and send them back. But and when they got to be too many, they were around and they started to make people nervous. Whenever you get a group of people that are different, and there's a lot of them, I think we mentioned the Bible study the other day too, and the Hebrews were multiplying. People get nervous, and so they have some quotas for immigration of the Chinese. And I think then there was another wave of immigration. There was some Japanese immigration, and after the war, there was Filipino immigration. So it's like every other after every group that comes, they suddenly say, "Well, we have enough of them," and establish some kind of a quota, and then another group is allowed in until it seems like there's enough of them. And so there's been this kind of wave, and a very uncomfortable one that I wasn't really aware of, in the last few years. Now, of course, our major immigration has been some years ago from Southeast Asia, and also particularly now from Central America. And a difference, something different started to happen, however, when we got to Central America. And it was a different kind of problem that we felt in our country, and that had to do with the nature of the relationship between our countries. We had always had Mexicans coming across to California to work in the fields, and then they'd go home again. And there's always been some illegal immigration across the border. But it wasn't until there was great numbers of Central Americans that came that people started to get uneasy. The government got a little upset about this. And so there was a point reached just a few years ago in which there was sort of a climax of some of this. There were people on the border, particularly in the churches, discovered that there were new refugees being held in detention camps that they hadn't been aware of before, and they were from El Salvador or from Guatemala. And they started to say, well, what are you here for, and why are you here? And started to realize the end of the 70s, early 80s, that these people were escaping war in their country. And they started to become aware of this war in Central America that now is so much in the news, and found out that if they tried to find these refugees, the government was not letting them know their names, nor where they were being held, and they were deporting them. And so a whole new awareness arose about a group of people that were starting to be a little bit invisible, even as they were making a big impact on particularly the Pacific, the southwestern areas of the country. And so churches became very concerned about this and started to work with these refugees. And they discovered more and more and more, and tried to work with them legally with lawyers to try to get them political asylum, which they felt they needed, or whatever asylum they needed as they were escaping difficult situations. Many had been tortured and arrested, and found out the government was not going to give them asylum. And so they came up with a whole new problem. We'd been very willing to take refugees from Southeast Asia. At least the government was willing to accept them. We've had problems sometimes in communities finding homes for them, but it somehow was different. They just had a totally different mindset for Central America. Like less than 2% of anybody who applied received asylum. And so there was a whole new approach decided that had to happen to this. And some of the churches said, well, the government may not say these people are in danger of losing their lives if they go home, but our understanding as we talk to them, as we study the situation, is that it's true, and we think that they should be given asylum. And so they started giving them asylum, even though they didn't have legal recourse for that. And that was sort of the birth of what's known as the sanctuary movement. Has anybody here had any contact with the sanctuary movement? It was a group that has often been presented in different ways, depending on who talks about it. But basically, it was a group that was birthed in the church that sought to give safe haven or a safe place for people who were escaping war, even when our government said that they would not do that, because they didn't acknowledge that there was any reason for them to be escaping from their countries. So there was a real dilemma the church was put in. You may know that the sanctuary trials in Tucson last year had come into being because there was a carload of people picked up near the border, and there was a Roman Catholic nun driving the car with a Methodist, I think, and the three refugees from El Salvador were Lutheran. So it was a real ecumenical carload, but they were all picked up. And that was how the first sanctuary trial came about. And a very difficult experience, because our government is really dead set against acknowledging the fact that these people have any reason to be here. But that was a whole new era for the church, and a lot of people rallied around this, and they said, you know, we're not disobeying the law as the government said they were. The government's disobeying the law because they're not providing sanctuary. I mean, they signed refugee acts, they have the UN protocol on refugees they signed. International law says you have to accept refugees. Therefore, since our government is disobeying the law, we're not criminals. We're the ones, but they couldn't get this admitted into court as a proper line of defense, and so they were convicted and mostly given either house arrest or some probation some paroled sentences. But basically, there was a real move there in solidarity with Central America, and suddenly new awareness of what was going on there. So that's been going on. Churches have struggled with this. How can we do something that's against, the government says is against the law? But it's been a constant movement, just like sort of the Underground Railroad was in the Civil War. It's been compared to that, of helping people, even before the government realized that was needed. But something new is happening, and that's really what I'd like to focus on today with refugees. A lot of people say, well, refugees are just coming here and they're going to take our jobs and we're going to have all these problems. And a lot of these are myths that have been disproven. I know, for instance, where I lived in Los Angeles for 4 years, that I think if they kicked out undocumented refugees, the whole economy would go under. I mean, you go into the, especially the garment district or any of the service industries, and they're entirely Central Americans that are working there. And they pay Social Security too, and they hardly ever claim it. But there's a whole a lot of studies done on the economic impact of refugees, and they discovered it is not the negative impact that has been portrayed to us. So anyway, this is still a big issue, and it's not really decided. And there are some books about it, and that present both the church's rationale for doing this and some of the consequences of it. This is a resource guide for understanding and participating in the Central American refugee struggle. It's a very good resource for that. Presents some of the implications of that. Also, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services put out this guide, which is very good, called Seeking Safe Haven, a congregational guide to helping Central American refugees in the United States. And it gives you some of the, again, some of the experiences of other congregations who want to consider this. But just in the last 2.5 years, something different has happened with the refugees. All of a sudden, not every refugee wants to come to the United States, but they still want our help. And they've been asking for it in a very unique way that I've never seen happen quite before in refugee work. And that is that in the war that's been going on in El Salvador, there have been thousands killed and thousands more displaced, both within El Salvador and also outside in refugee camps in Honduras, and of course the refugees who arrived here. And this is basically a result of the government's policy down there. I heard this the other day that it was Mao Zedong who had an image about fish and water that said that fish obviously can't swim if there isn't water. And so the government of El Salvador says the only reason guerrillas are surviving still and we haven't defeated them is because the people, the campesinos, are helping them. Therefore, if we remove the campesinos from their homes in the hills and in the mountains and on the border, the guerrillas will have no support and will wipe them out. So they purposefully went around and depopulated entire regions, burning homes and pushing people over the border into refugee camps. And there have been several documented massacres of people who resisted that. But they basically said, you just can't farm here because we're going to be fighting. You have to leave. And so we have people that have been living in refugee camps within El Salvador or outside for up to 8 years in some cases. And it's a very, I don't know if anybody's visited a refugee camp. Has anybody been involved in refugee camps? You have in Ethiopia or
El Salvador?
Oh, you were there. Okay, then you can add to this perhaps too. But they're generally not exciting places for the most part, and they're because you have no freedom to leave. You're really trapped in a place. It is, in the sense of concentration camp, you're concentrated in this area and can't move and have military guards around you to make sure you don't leave, with also the idea that they're protecting you, but in Honduras, for example, is the case. Within El Salvador, it's not always that they have military guards around them, but they still don't feel the freedom to move. They feel like others look at them as suspect because they're strange to that place. Even though they've been very creative in many places in how they've dealt with their refugee situation by working together cooperatively and developing trades and education within those, they still have this idea that they can't work freely. And how can they raise their children to be farmers, which is what they are when they're caught in this refugee camp. And finally, just 2 years ago, several refugees decided they'd had enough of being refugees, displaced people. They were going to go home. And they decided that no matter what the government said, that they were going to go back to their homes. And if the government was going to fight there, they were going to say to the government, you can't fight there because we're going to be farming here. And just, you know, kind of turn the tables on them, which is a very courageous and, I suppose you might say, crazy thing to do. I mean, I would think it sounds crazy anyway I look at it. And yet they started to do this. It was the beginning of a movement. I think the first group that went back was to San Jose Las Flores. It was a town outside of El Salvador. And I think there were groups from a couple of different refugee camps got together, and they went back, they walked back to their homes and settled in. But in order to do this, there were two things that were important to them particularly. One was that they go in a group, a large group. The government has always said you can always go home whenever you want, sort of. I mean, even though they moved them all out, they said, sure, return if you want. But individuals going back often disappeared, or they lost track, or they couldn't survive alone when they're used to living in community, or they didn't have what they needed to start planting, and it was just very difficult for their status. So they decided they wanted to go back as a community, not as individuals. And they decided if they were going to go back, they needed some international support. And so they called on Christians and other concerned individuals throughout the world to be with them and accompany them in their journey. Because they figured, well, if they went in a group, they were very visible and less, and also able to support each other as they set up their homes again. It wasn't like one person trying to do everything, but as a collective, they would be able to survive. And then they also decided that with internationals there, they'd have international press and attention, and people couldn't wipe them out as easily then either, because the world would be upset if this happened. So a call went out for accompaniment, they called. And that was sort of the beginning of a whole new movement in refugees really taking control of their own situation. And we refer to it as the accompaniment movement. But it's a movement that's been very much fueled by their understandings of the scriptures, the Old Testament prophets, when they say, you will go home and rebuild your homes and replant your vineyards. They read these texts and they said, that's us, you know, we're going home. You know, we are these people and God wants us to do this. I mean, they are firmly convinced of that. And I think that's part of the craziness, I guess, of the gospel, is it manifests itself in whatever situation we're in. And they did it. And not without a lot of struggle. But that was the very first one. And there were two major ones since then. And the second one, I have a brief 15-minute recording of some of the impressions of the internationals who were accompanying them on this trip. And this trip was a little bit different, though. This trip that was going back to a place called El Barrio, and they had to go through a town called Aguacayo at first to get there. And it was going to be a little difficult to get to that place because there has been heavy fighting there, and the military really controlled that zone. But they decided they were going to try to do this anyway. And that's why this tape is called Return to Aguacayo. And you'll find out why it's only Aguacayo instead of El Barrio at this point. But this was a worrisome one. But this was just the second attempt of a group of refugees in El Salvador to return to their home. And the reason I want to show the tape is it's better for you to hear their own voices and to maybe sense some of the spirit with which they do this. And then I visited there last year, it was in the spring, after they'd been there for over a year. So I just want to share a few impressions with you of my visit then and then whatever discussion we want to have. So were there any questions just up to this? The first repopulation was in June to San Jose Las Flores, and this was the second one.
1986, a military operation began on the slopes of the Guazapo volcano in El Salvador. It was called Operation Phoenix. For 10 continuous days, the Salvadoran army, aided by United States advisors, bombed and strafed the countryside. During this operation, government troops killed 22 civilians and captured or disappeared 213 others. The army also burned 22 villages, displacing 2,000 people. Like the scorched earth tactics used in Vietnam, Operation Phoenix destroyed all homes, fields, and livestock. Nothing remained which could sustain life. Thank you. This attack was part of a strategy which continues today throughout El Salvador. Its purpose is to remove the civilian population from the countryside and keep the guerrillas from having contact with them.
Have you read the book by Mao Zedong? The fish without the water will die. The gorilla without the support of the population will also die.
The survivors of Operation Phoenix were taken to refugee camps in San Salvador. A number of them wanted to return to rebuild their destroyed homes and fields in defiance of the government. They asked for an international presence to guarantee their safety. 6 months after Operation Phoenix, I joined a delegation of 19 North Americans who went to El Salvador. We were to accompany 450 displaced members of a farming cooperative located near the bombed-out town of Aguacayo. They believed that our presence would keep the Salvadoran military from shooting or arresting them. We had no idea what we would be getting into.
Besides that, they had killed two of my sons, one daughter-in-law, one grandchild. They were all killed by the army. We are not here in Europe. But as a direct consequence of the repression of the armed forces, we have no desire to continue here. We want to go back to cultivate the land, to see if we can have a better life, not to live just waiting as we are doing here. It is only for the goodwill of other nations that we have not yet died from hunger or from the repression of this war.
We immediately felt solidarity with their struggle to reclaim their land. Their hope and courage was contagious. It was hard to think some people would be staying behind.
I won't be able to go this time because I have a son in Mariona prison.
No one can separate us from that land, because that land saw you being born and watched you growing up. That land which God has given you. This land and this place which is yours. You are going to go back and live there, and God will live there with you. And there will be tests, and perhaps some will suffer more than others. It is a test to see up to what point the people want to continue searching for this liberation, searching for this justice, and this brotherhood for everyone.
We are all one heart and one feeling now. We are going with this faith and this greatness. You told us, Lord, that there is a promised land for your people after so much spilled blood. We are reclaiming this land for you, Eternal Father, and for your beloved Son.
Hace dos lo que te estamos pidiendo y que todo ello sea para tu gloria, para hacer tu reino de paz, la justicia, la libertad y amor. Te lo pedimos y te lo ofrecemos por Jesucristo nuestro Señor.
After we arrived, 450 people from camps around the capital gathered their few belongings, said goodbye to their friends, and started an uncertain journey back to their land. In the Plaza de Libertad, they boarded 10 rented buses. The delegates got on different buses so we could offer the people protection in case they were stopped by government troops.
though the bombs may always threaten, and the soldier hold the gun. We have burned the flag to burn, and our freedom has begun. Crossing through the lines of terror, where the checkpoint army stands, come 450 people in a banner caravan.
When we arrived in the town of Aguacayo, 2 miles from El Barrio, the farming cooperative that was our final destination, we were met by soldiers. They told us that we didn't have permission to be in a zone of conflict. The road was mined, and that meant we couldn't go any farther. We didn't have the numbers with all of our efforts and didn't connect.
We are all citizens, and we have every right to return to our homes and work our land. Don't be scared. Don't be afraid. We aren't alone. We are all one people. We are all Christians, and we're among brothers and sisters. We can count on international support, and we also have the press with us, so that if something should happen to us, they'll see it. We've lived through 7 years of war. We've lived through very difficult moments. So now, why can't we stay here for 4 or 5 days? If the armed forces say they're going to provide security, let's not be afraid of them anymore. Let's tell them what we want, what our life has been in the refugee camps, and that we don't want to live as refugees anymore. We want to work on our land to be able to support our families, and this is the only thing we want. We haven't come to fight with anyone, but only to start our cooperative once again and work like all Salvadorans, which we are.
We decided to camp in Aguacayo until the road could be checked for lines.
Goodbye to the shelter of many near the town. This life is no meaning with the courage of the child who holds a family rooster and lays among the ruins. Healing scars along her arms from when the cornfield burns.
The next morning, Lieutenant Colonel Carranza arrived with his troops. Despite our faith and determination to reach El Barrio, it seemed the soldiers were not giving in. The same soldiers who forced these people from their homes now ask them to identify their male relatives.
Song.
more troops arrived. We were suddenly separated from the Salvadorans, carried to trucks, and driven to a police station in the nearby town of Suchitoto. Two representatives of the United States Embassy in San Salvador were flown in by helicopters to convince us to go back to the capital. Although this took a number of relatives to see who would remain here, first to the people, and on the island. The rest of us would go to San Salvador and ask the military for permission to continue our journey. A phone call came from the U.S. Embassy. Ambassador Edwin Corr ordered all of us to be taken.
Our guide was a stop along the way. Where the rifles are protecting friends away. But struggle with a simple dread and sighs with the wind. Let's join our arms in prayer and plow the precious earth.
International pressure resulting from the publicity about our arrest and deportation prevented the Salvadoran military from harming the people we had left behind in Aguapayo. They were allowed to return to their land and rebuild their homes. A few months later, we received a letter from El Barrio.
Dear brothers and sisters, you can't imagine how often we remember those very difficult moments you spent with us in Aguacayo. Thanks to your help, we were able to return to our homes. We have now constructed a health center and a school and made preparations to bring water to the community. We have planted corn, rice, beans, sesame, peanuts, and vegetable gardens. In spite of difficulties, we are very happy here. We will never forget them. We admire your capacity to love us. We know that when you are far away, you continue to struggle to bring peace to our poor countries.
That one was sort of closely watched. That was the only time people were deported, which is something you usually try to avoid when you're accompanying somebody. It's sort of gives you mixed publicity. But I also know that some of those same people who were deported were also able to return the following year. Either their records didn't show that in El Salvador or anything. But as they said in the letter, the people were able to return to El Barrio and to be able to plant crops. One interesting thing is, I have here the report. This is an annual report of the Lutheran World Federation from El Salvador. Does anybody here know Pastor Phil Anderson? He was, you know him from probably when he was in Colombia.
Right.
Yeah, he is now the Lutheran World Federation representative in El Salvador. And when I visited last March, we went out there to visit El Barrio. And the people took us around. They showed us their crops that had been coming in and that they had planted, and the bees that they were raising. And then they took us to show us Felipe's well. And Lutheran World Federation had provided money for the well and the motor for the well. And so it was known throughout El Barrio as Felipe's well. And so we went and watched it work. And there, I mean, water is a very important thing there. So they were also able to provide seeds and introduce soybeans also to the cooperative, which is the first time they planted soybeans. But needless to say, they still live a very precarious existence there because they have a military checkpoint right at the entrance of the community. And even for us to be able to visit that community, we had to go to the military high command and ask for special permission just to go out on that road. So they live with a sense knowing that the military controls everything that goes in and out of their community, everybody. And they live with the insecurity of that. But basically, they progress even faster than they anticipated in terms of being able to become a self-sufficient cooperative again. So it's one of the really, it ended up being a very positive story, although this film ended at the moment where it was most in doubt, the people stuck in Aguacayo and the internationals deported. But it became a very good example of what the people can do when they do repopulate. I put up here too, immigration is one way people move around. Sanctuary was the other first one I mentioned that we've had a lot of work with. Repopulation is what this was. We call this a repopulation because they moved from one place to the other. And now repatriation is another thing that's been happening. It's the same thing as repopulation, but it's referred to when you cross over a border. For instance, this was in July. In January, a Lutheran refugee camp in San Salvador called Fe y Esperanza, Faith and Hope, resettled in a new area called Panchimilama, or it's near Panchimilama. And they set up their place there. And that was the last major repopulation until last year. In October, there was a massive repatriation of refugees from Mesa Grande camp in Honduras. 4,500 refugees returned. I mean, that was a major endeavor to get all these refugees to get permission to cross borders, because you had the Honduran government and military, and you had the Salvadoran military. You had the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees involved. I mean, everybody. And then you had these international delegations that were visiting every week to Mesa Grande saying, what can we do to help? And they could say, oh, you can do this. And there on this little plateau in the middle of Honduras, you had this group of refugees that were locked in this camp, you know, causing tremendous things to happen, reverberations to be felt around the world. And actually, in October, then were able to go back to their communities in El Salvador, about five of them, where they formerly had their homes and they've been rebuilt. So that's, I think, in terms of what I've been able to see, that's probably one of the most exciting things that's been happening in Central America in terms of a movement that's a movement of hope, and as they see it, a movement towards peace that we are also invited to be a part of, just as we were in the sanctuary movement, but in a very different way in terms of the accompaniment. And I think it's a really vital thing that's going on. I have a few pictures from when I visited El Barrio. I realized some of Suchitoto that they mentioned that was, I don't think I have a picture of the well. For all the fuss they made about the well, I didn't even get a picture. I was probably too much fuss. I was too busy working it, but I'll just pass these around if you're interested in those. I have some others of El Salvador, but those are the ones particularly. Well, actually, I do the Panchimilama one also. These ones that are very wooded are the Panchimilama ones. And I can also pass those around. And then I also have a couple of Mesa Grande, which is when Bishop Medardo Gomez visited there, visited the refugees. They asked him to come. So I'll pass these over here. Also, I just put two addresses up here. One's Going Home. It's part of the Share Foundation. They mentioned that on the tape. And that's an organization, ecumenical organization in Washington, D.C., that's been helping coordinate the internationals who went and accompanied refugees. I was on a delegation last August, just prior to their moving, and we visited, for instance, the government and the embassy and the refugees and tried to help facilitate communication for them. The LUCOLA, Lutheran Coalition on Latin America, is a coalition that I coordinate. It's basically a coalition of Lutheran groups that have Central America as either a major or one part of their agenda. And we try to network among Lutherans and try particularly to make our own church aware and responsive to some of the needs as they appear, and to work with the church in that sense. And Lutheran Immigration Refugee Service is a part of that too. So that is also, and we have been supportive of some of the repopulated communities. But
the bombing at Fez Bronza, was that was prior to them moving out of that?
No, that was after they moved. That was what was very strange. The bombing, you heard that last August, the end of August, there was a bomb placed in the daycare center of the Fe Esperanza refugee camp, and the one run by the Lutherans in San Salvador. And that was in August, and the people had moved in January. The majority of the families had already moved to Panchimilama. So all that was left in the camp were children, because Bishop Gomez hoped to turn that into an orphanage. And so there were a few adults there and the children. It was 3 in the morning, the bomb went off, and left this huge crater in the building, and had a metal door on the daycare center that blew clear across the soccer field. It was a very powerful bomb, and nobody was hurt because of the time of day, but the message was very clear and very disturbing, obviously, to everybody. And, you know, what it couldn't mean much else other than the church better watch what it does, and the church took the message that way. But, What group did you go with when you went down there? Were you with?
I went down with a Lutheran group from Texas with Dan Long.
Oh, did you? Okay. Was that sponsored by CRISPAS? Or was it just a...
No, the Southern District of the American Lutheran Church at that time yearly sent delegations down to be a presence and also to come back and be resource people.
Oh, good.
For education and fundraising.
Mm-hmm. And what year was that you went
in?
It's a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was before the repopulations were taking place.
Right.
And they were still...
There were co-ops. Its funding had just been cut off, the big co-op mess with the United States. But so I think that idea was beginning.
Yeah, the seeds of the idea were... Yeah, the cooperatives have been very big in El Salvador and have had a lot of different support. But Dan Long has been part of the steering committee of LUCOLA, so we've been connected through that. Another Lutheran has been very involved in issues. I also have over on the table some assorted things I brought with me that I don't plan to take home with me. I have some newsletters from LUCOLA. I have 2 magazines that have come out of New York, of a group called the New York Circus. One is a translation of a magazine that comes out of Nicaragua called Amanecer, which means dawn. And it's a very new, it's a very unique magazine. It comes out of an ecumenical center there and presents very much liberation theology perspective of what's happening in Central America. And now it's available for the first time in English. And there's some order forms over there. And Lucha, which is the newspaper or magazine that the circus puts out. I also have a couple of reports up there that were actually written by Dan Long, because he reached recently this year, earlier visited the repopulated community of Panchimilama and wrote a report on what had happened there, because they purchased some new land that we had helped raise money for alongside the lake, so that they would have more farming land and they'd be able to perhaps do fishing as well, because economically they didn't have a strong enough base where they were in Panchimilama. So his report on that visit is up there too, and you're free to help yourself to anything up there that you like. But basically, I just think that it's very, I don't know where this is all going to end up. I mean, after 8 years of war and the bickering that goes on in Congress about how much money to send to the military and how much to send to the Contras, and then the constant reports that come out of those countries. I heard Bishop Gomez 2 weeks ago in Milwaukee, he was speaking at Lutheran Human Relations Institute, and just very clearly saying, you know, we have to somehow stop the arms being fueling the military because it's killing our people. In fact, he went so far as to suggest we ought to have a change of government in this country this year. He thought that would
That's not exactly a revolutionary.
No, it's not. No, it's not, but it's the first step. And but it's a sort of a consistent message that those of us who've been there or have talked to people who've been there hear. And it's amazing to me, it's so hard to do that, you know. There's some pretty strong forces against that. But I think the fact that, another thing too I mentioned, I keep forgetting this, I mentioned this before to several people, and this is in line, I think what the refugees are doing in terms of taking control of their destiny and saying, we're not going to be refugees anymore, they have to somehow stop this fighting and really just sort of putting themselves in the way with their bodies is related to this document that just came out, was signed April 3rd in Managua, Nicaragua, by over 100 Christians in Central America. And what it is, you've all heard of the Kairos document that came out of South Africa a couple of years ago? It was a faith perspective on the political reality of South Africa. And basically what they're saying is, how we deal with apartheid. This is a moment in history that we will be judged in how we deal with apartheid. And we have a chance to do something about it now, but we can't go on like this. And this is another document that came out of Central America that says pretty much the same thing, that we're in a crisis moment right now, and this is a God-given moment of opportunity to change the flow of history that's been, as they see it, 450 years of a lot of oppression and a lot of struggle and a lot of death and a lot of war. And as this document points out, the U.S. has been rather considerably involved in this. And it's an opportunity to turn things around. And they say never before in history have the poor people, which is not, as we perceive in some countries, a small group of poor people, but rather the great mass of people, it's been so aware that they are the subjects of their own history. I mean, it's a whole new mindset right now. And never before has solidarity been so strong, international awareness so high. And never before has there been a sense of sort of the convergence of so many of these things that make it possible that perhaps not only is peace possible, but really there could be a whole new order for doing things, and that we need to respond to that. So this was written as a challenge. It says, a challenge to the churches of the world. And that includes us. And in the end here, they describe their situation as they see their history and what's going on right now, what the issues are. At the end, they have challenges for themselves. They have some urgent demands of the U.S. government. They have requests addressed to other Latin American governments, an appeal to churches and Christians of the world, and then the urgent need for a new order with justice and peace. And I've left a copy of this in the reference library if anybody would like to look at it. It's not widely known yet. It's only like 1,000 copies have been sent out in English. And we're trying to get more out and interest generated for people to explore this, because it's something that we need to be in dialogue with. And I think it's part of the same movement that's going on, and it's something that's going to go on whether we dialogue or not. But it's also not just God's opportunity for something to be different in Central America, but it's also an opportunity for us to reflect on how we stand in relationship to that and to respond in some way. So I would urge you, if you have the interest, to check this out. It says in the back where you can order one from as well. And I've also offered to send one to anybody if they'd like it, if they give me their name and address. But I really do think that it is sort of an urgent moment in history that...
Not just the mainline Protestant churches, but even the evangelicals cooperating with the Catholics, it's got to be a pretty compelling thing.
Very unique situation, especially in Nicaragua. That's not true, for example, in Guatemala. you have evangelicals starting churches on corners. I mean, they just spring up overnight with lots of money, and with a very questionable theology. I mean, just total otherworldly theology. And a lot of people strongly and with some foundation suspect U.S. covert money going into those evangelical churches. And it's a very strange situation as people perceive it.
The Catholic Church is not unanimous about that. Part of the Catholic
not in any country,
is,
yeah.
Is the other way around, which is something new for Catholicism.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's very. Yeah, it's funny because it was really the Second Vatican Council that started this whole thing, you know, in terms of giving people the chance to really get into the Bible, and they did, and this is what happened. And now it's sort of going back to the circle. The Pope says, well, wait a minute, you know, we didn't have in mind liberation theology. And so there's some resistance on certain levels, but I think it's too big of a thing and too powerful to halt that. But it is, and if anybody's interested in participating in an accompaniment, visiting some of these repopulated communities, there are a number of ways it can be done. And for instance, the Going Home campaign does continue to support some of the repopulated communities, and you could contact them also. So anyway, if there are any other questions, I think it's almost time for us to. We still have 3 minutes, but.
From refugees coming to America. Mm-hmm. I heard a man speak from FAIR that something.
I don't have the figures nationally right now.
The Immigration Department is probably a misnomer.
Right. Yeah, they're trying to keep more people out. Well, it's interesting, in New York, one of the major undocumented populations are the Irish. We probably have as many undocumented Irish as we do Central Americans.
An Indian chief was killed.
But people don't harass them the same way they do the Central Americans. It's very interesting.
An Indian chief was quoted as saying that we should watch our immigration laws. They were careless of theirs.
I love that. Oh, yes, it would have been a lot different had they not been that way. That's true. But I don't remember the figures right now. I sorted them out for our Synod Assembly because I needed to find out how many we had in our region. But it's very fluid as well, too. But, no, it's the inequality, in a sense, too, of the rationale. They fit all the rationale for receiving immigration status, except that our government denies the fact that their governments are killing them. You know, it's just this blanket thing, and I don't think it has to do with proximity. I think the reason there's so much public awareness is because of proximity. I mean, who could afford to travel to Vietnam? I mean, nobody could, or South Africa, or even Chile. But all of those had an impact on our society and our awareness of war and the consequences of it. But never before have so many Americans been able just, you know, for $400, $500 to go down and check it out for themselves and get to know the people. And so I think that kind of personal involvement has had incredible impact on the awareness. I wouldn't say that. It's when you're dealing with justice, you're not talking about proximity or distance. You're talking about the issues. Mm-hmm. And there are many ways to try to avoid the issues.
Right, with a lot of facts and figures.
Yeah. Somebody put on my desk the other day a newspaper article by Elliot Abrams talking about the success of Reagan's Central American policy. I thought, wow. I mean, it's like reading somebody who lives in another planet almost. You know, sort of, like, is this the same Central America that I know? But there's a whole different perspective looking at that totally skews what's that. I realized when I went to Nicaragua, you know, we took notes and everything we saw, and said, oh, this is wonderful, and that's wonderful. And we went to the embassy, U.S. embassy, and I said before they gave me their whole spiel, I said, tell me 5 things that you think the Nicaraguan government's done that's good. So the guy thought, he named all the things we'd figured out, you know, education, literacy, the medical care, the housing for the poor, and says, true, and very few governments care about the poor as much as this government. And then he started to say, but, and I said, oh, well, I didn't want to hear but, so, you know, that was fine, thank you. I thought, this is very interesting. They know all this. You know, I thought we were uncovering new facts and figures. And I realized at some point in that trip that it doesn't matter how many facts and figures you have. It doesn't matter how many good things the Nicaraguan government does or bad things, because the government sees one level as ideological. Their ideology is wrong, therefore they deserve to be overthrown. And I think that the people that go, and those of us who are trying to understand what's happening, see the issues and the people, like how is life different for this person or for that person, and what do they say, and those things count. But if, as long as you say we will not tolerate a socialist or Marxist or anything vaguely resembling that government in our hemisphere, all that other is just totally unimportant. And that's kind of a scary thing to me. It's a real deep thing, because even in Congress they talk about legislation, and it's not, most Congress people can be intimidated into voting a certain way because their constituency will think they support communism. And I realize deep down inside of us, we've never dealt with what communism is. And we don't know any shade between what we perceive as democracy and what we perceive as communism. And so it's so deep in our roots as a people and our lack of understanding that it's hard to deal with the issues. I should also mention, American Friends Service puts out very good things too. They have facts and fears about the communist threat in Central America. And I find this very helpful. I mean, it knows everything that everybody thinks and is afraid of. And they mention it, and they say, for instance, the Soviet Union exports revolution to Latin America. And then it talks about that. Is that true or isn't it? Is Nicaragua's military buildup a danger to other countries? And they have charts and figures, but it's a very... This is really almost, I think, at the core of what some undefinable, unarticulable fears are that we've never dealt with as a country. So anything anybody can do to help clarify that will be greatly appreciated by all of us. So, but anyway, thank you very much for coming. And
thank you.
It's time for Vespers almost. I should say also, in light of all the Methodists we have holding this week, that the Latin American solidarity movements are by and large all ecumenical. There's very few groups that really have any strong enough presence on their own, and that's been a real powerful thing.